This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Given the size and financial strength of some large colleges and universities in the U.S., it came as a bit of a surprise that a small liberal arts college in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts is the first institution in the country to go 100% solar.
I love the notion that this little poorly resourced college in snow country is the first that's going to go 100% solar. That seems to me a wonderful message.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the college president who got this project rolling. We'll also learn why many military families across the U.S. are opting to homeschool their children, hear about a grant project to study water contamination, and we'll spend an academic minute trying to bring extinct plants back from the dead. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Hampshire College, a small liberal arts college located in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, is well on its way to becoming 100% solar for the electricity used on campus. It is believed to be a first for a residential college anywhere in the U.S. Tests were recently conducted to clear the way for the college to connect the massive array of solar panels installed on two fields to the local electric grid. Construction on the solar project started back in the summer of 2016. The Best of Our Knowledge's Paul Tuthill spoke with Hampshire College President Jonathan Lash about where the project stands as they head into the winter.
We are turning on the second of two fields of 15,000 solar photovoltaic collectors, which are hooked up to Hampshire College and to the grid. And once we do that, we will become, we believe, the first residential college in the United States that is 100% dependent on solar for electricity. That's on an annualized basis. Obviously, we aren't going to generate any electricity late at night in February, but we'll be generating much more than we use in the middle of the day in July. And when you add it all up at the end of the year, we'll have generated more than we use.
So do you store this electricity or you sell it back to the grid?
We put it back in the grid and we add up the accounts at the end.
And so it's by this calculation that you expect to be 100% solar?
Yes. We do have an arrangement. The contractor who has installed the solar fields for us is Solar City, which is owned by Tesla. And they have supplied us with a big bank of Tesla batteries, which are our backup power and also enable us to supply power to the campus on winter evenings when there's peak power demand and the rates go way up. So we're able to reduce the demand on the utility at a period when it's difficult for them to meet the demand and supply energy to them in the summer on hot days when everybody's running their air conditioner.
Now, you're not going off the grid completely, though.
No, that would be very, very difficult for a big institution like this to do. And this arrangement essentially means that we are in a collaboration with our utility Eversource. It's one that works well for us because we pay 13.5 cents a kilowatt hour for our electricity, but we will only pay 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour for the solar electricity. So we're saving a lot of money.
Yeah, those numbers sound pretty good from what I'm familiar with other solar projects. How were you able to get such favorable terms?
It's a very big project in which we're supplying the land and in which we were willing to sign a 20-year power purchase agreement. So they were able to get very favorable financing for the project.
And as you said, you supplied the land. I believe it was, it's 19 acres in total. Is that correct?
19 acres. And it was such an interesting process, Paul. We got students involved from the moment we began considering doing this, in writing the request for proposals, in evaluating the proposals we got from different vendors, in thinking about how ambitious we wanted. And I pushed very hard for 100%. And then in making the selection of where would we put these collectors and having to go through the process of thinking about, well, if we use agricultural land, it's taken out of production. What are our standards for that? Does it do any damage to the land? then in working with the neighbors to make sure that everybody was comfortable with the project. For us, that was almost the best part of the project because it became part of the curriculum. Think if you were a first-year student at college, and instead of sitting in a lecture hall hearing lectures about solar power, you were out designing a system that made your college the first 100% solar college. It's just a fabulous experience.
There are always lessons learned from projects like this. What are some of the lessons you learned that might be beneficial to someone else contemplating a project on this scale?
Well, we were very glad that we started from the very beginning and had a campus committee that included students and faculty and staff and got them completely engaged. We were very glad that we reached out to all of the neighbors from the beginning. It took us a year and a half longer to actually reach this point of being able to turn on the collectors than we expected, and we should have planned around that. The panels were all installed almost a year and a half ago, but it's a long process to get hooked up to the grid, and we hadn't planned around that.
Why is that? Why is it such a lengthy process?
The utility needs to put the equipment in place so that they can handle the power flow going both directions and large amounts of power flowing both directions. And the towns need to approve all the changes that the utility makes. So, you know, the selectmen had to approve the installation of new telephone poles, and that just took time.
Since environmental advocacy is your background before you became president of Hampshire College, I've got to ask you the environmental question. What's the impact here?
We'll avoid about 3,000 metric tons of CO2 emissions a year. That's the equivalent of taking, I don't know, 600 or 700 cars off the road. It's a really significant impact. And the list of colleges now doing solar projects is just getting longer by the day because the economics has shifted. I mean, it's shifted in the last 5 years in a dramatic way. And I think a lot of institutions are saying, you know, if they can't get this right in Washington, we're just going to go ahead and do it. And I find that very encouraging.
This is part of a long-term sustainability initiative, which I believe you started 5 years ago. Update us, if you would, on that. Where are you along the way? How far are you and towards your goal?
So the point of the initiative was for students to be part of a process that asks the question that I think is going to be essential for many of them going forward in the next 20, 25 years, which is, okay, how do we organize the economy around the concept of sustainability? And we need to ask that question about food. We need to ask that question about buildings. We need to ask that a question about the way we operate our farms. So we've tried to basically demonstrate all of that here on the campus. We have a new living building that produces its own energy and treats its own waste. That's going really well. We got students involved and decided we were going to stop mowing scores of acres of land and let it grow into pasture and take the hay off once a year. So a lot less lawn, a lot more pasture, a lot more songbirds. It's part of the science work that students do, measuring the return of the songbirds, looking at the impact of not mowing 20 or 30 acres of lawn and the CO2 reductions. We tried to give them the experience of thinking about how we feed ourselves and what the implications of that are for sustainability and for the local community. And I think if you did a questionnaire, you'd find that for a lot of the students, that's really important, that they really believe in that.
Anything else you'd like people to know about what you're doing up there?
I love the notion that this little poorly resourced college with its endowment of under $50 million in snow country is the first that's going to go 100% solar. That seems to me a wonderful message. And I love the fact that I can't remember whether you and I talked about this before. The crew that came to install these panels was from coal country. They were from Kentucky. This is the future.
Jonathan Lash is the president of Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle. As schools around the country get ready for winter break, a small but growing number of children won't be returning after that break. Homeschooling is becoming more common among military families. Reporter Patricia Murphy looked into the reasons why.
It's the middle of the school day for the Owen children, but you won't find them in a classroom. Six of the seven Owen kids are at Sunnyside Beach in Washington State with their mom, Becky.
Zoe, you can make a dream catcher.
While 4-year-old Zoe and 6-year-old Joshua look for feathers, 15-year-old Hannah was dreading her next task.
I'm going to make dream catchers. I got to do like boring stuff like memorize parts of the Constitution.
The Owens are being homeschooled, and this beach trip is part of today's curriculum. They're a military family. Becky Owen's husband joined the Army in 2005, and she says it made sense to homeschool her children because the family moved around so much.
Our first duty station was Germany. But even before we got there, you know, he had basic training, and then he had the other training, and so we just kept homeschooling through all of this because it gave us the flexibility we needed. My kids would have had to be in and out of schools 3 times before Germany.
A decade after their stint in Germany, the 6 school-aged children are still learning at home in DuPont, Washington, near where their dad is stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. 18-year-old Deborah says it's been a great experience for her.
Instead of being caught up with all the tests and all the grades and all the stuff that stresses out all of my peers, I've been able to focus on what I really care about and want to pursue.
The Owens are among what seems to be a growing trend. Homeschooling is becoming more popular among the population as a whole. And while the Department of Defense doesn't track the number of homeschoolers, a study conducted for the Army suggested military families are more likely to homeschool than civilian families are. Tom Halverson of the University of Washington College of Education says the nomadic life of military families is one of the biggest reasons they homeschool. Military kids move an average of 9 times before age 17.
That could be a very challenging and chaotic situation for kids, completely jumping into new situations, new classrooms, new students, new teachers, new surroundings. And so a homeschooling situation where students could have that consistency, I think, could be a real advantage.
Like homeschoolers in general, some military parents also want to give their children a religious education or pursue their own curriculum. But Halverson says homeschooling isn't right for everyone.
Especially for older kids, I think that's where you would start to run into a real challenge for parents, is trying to be able to devote enough time to be able to stay ahead of the kids and really provide a balanced instruction for them through some of those tougher subjects.
That's a lesson that Jen Stahl learned when she was homeschooled in the 1990s as her family traveled the world with her Navy dad. She now lives with her husband and 2 kids in Germany and belongs to a group that advocates for tougher homeschooling oversight. When we talked with her on Skype, she recalled the strong military influence of her homeschool education.
It was boot camp, basically, at home. I actually would joke with people and say, you know, the only reason I didn't enlist is because I've already done boot camp.
Even Becky Owen, an enthusiastic homeschooler, ended up putting one of her daughters in a school run by the U.S. Department of Defense in Germany. It happened when her 6-year-old was having trouble reading.
It wasn't clicking for her. She was very stubborn. She thought only dad could teach her how to read, and then dad was being deployed. And so we had her tested, and turns out that she had visual tracking issues. And she would go every day for reading lessons or reading class.
Like the rest of the Owen children, though, Hannah eventually went back to full-time homeschooling. And Becky Owen says although every one of her children is different, the family figured out what learning style works for each of them. The Department of Defense says it neither encourages nor discourages homeschooling among military families, and it has no data to compare the academic achievement of military homeschooled children to other kids. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
Still to come, a Massachusetts scientist has won a grant to study contamination in the country's water supply. We'll talk to her next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A scientist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst recently received a grant to study the health effects of two perfluorinated chemicals. Given drinking water contamination issues around the country in places like Flint, Michigan and Rensselaer County, New York, the Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn spoke with the grantee about what she and her colleagues hope to accomplish.
Environmental health scientist Alicia Timmy Larrigy received the $1.9 million grant from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to study the health effects of the two environmental pollutants. She and her colleagues will assess the effects of the toxicity of PFOS, perfluorooctane sulfonate, and its replacement chemical, PFBS, perfluorobutane sulfonate, on three species of embryos. The idea is to look at preconception exposure.
The mother is, you know, exposed to all of these contaminants in the environment, and, you know, during the meantime, you know, her body's doing the normal things that a woman's body would do in terms of, you know, getting an egg ready to ovulate, and these chemicals can affect that process. And so that's what we're trying to look at, is how these perfluorinated chemicals are interacting with the nutrients that are being put in to that egg before conception even occurs.
There are a number of emerging contaminants, but Timmy Larrigy says she chose to study PFOS and PFBS because of previous research on PFOS.
We have done some work actually doing some developmental studies, you know, so along the same vein, you know, looking at this concept of developmental origins of disease, and we were really startled to find in a paper that we published earlier this year that exposure to PFAS pretty dramatically affected the way that the pancreas is formed. So we were really intrigued by this, and there are other reports out there about PFAS being transferred from the mother into the egg. And so part of what we're trying to figure out is, are these effects on the developing pancreas, you know, which is your major nutrient sensing organ and is related to, you know, metabolic syndrome and diabetes and all of these health effects, you know, is that disruption coming from exposure to PFAS itself, or is it more of a nutrient alteration? So are the building blocks, you know, for a developing organism, are those being kind of hijacked by these perfluorinated compounds that are then being deposited into the egg?
She and her colleagues will assess effects on nutrient deposition in the embryos of three different organisms, with exposure before conception, as well as consequences for later life metabolic dysfunction. Timmy Larrigy says if the same thing occurs in the fish, the fly, and the worm, it gives scientists some confidence that there is relevance for human health.
So the problem with, you know, trying to address these sorts of questions in humans is that we are exposed to a soup of chemicals every day, and it's very difficult to pinpoint a causal agent, you know, when you're being exposed to so many things at once. In the laboratory, we can really narrow down and look very specifically, do we see, you know, these sorts of effects resulting from this specific chemical exposure, and when did that exposure occur? At what point during development is that most important? So we're using the zebrafish, which it might sound strange to be using a fish to study human health, but we can do this because there's so much in common between those early life stages, between humans and fish. And by adding in these parallel studies that my colleagues are conducting using the roundworm and the fruit fly, we're really able to create a really powerful model taking advantage of what we know about evolution. And if we see these conserved effects happening, you know, from three different organisms, that makes a really strong case that, you know, if we identify certain genes that are being changed in our model systems, we can make a pretty good case that this would also be happening in humans as well.
The study will last for 5 years.
What we try to do is we look at what the concentrations are out in the environment. You know, so we read the literature and look at what people are reporting that they're finding in drinking water systems. We look at the NHANES database, and we look at what concentrations are being reported to be found in people. We try to make sure that the concentrations of chemical that we're using in the laboratory are going to be meaningful for what people would be exposed to.
Timmy Larigi says the stain-repellent chemical PFOS used in making nonstick coatings, for example, is toxic and very stable in the environment. The half-life of PFOS in the human body is more than 5 years, and it may persist in the environment for decades. Timmy Larigi also says exposure is associated with higher cancer rates, diabetes, and other diseases. In recent years, PFOS has been replaced by PFBS, which is believed to persist for less time in the body and the environment.
You know, part of what we're trying to figure out is whether or not this replacement perfluorinated compound, PFBS, is going to be, you know, more or less toxic compared to what we know about PFOS.
Zebrafish embryos are transparent, so scientists can see the embryo developing in real time under a microscope. And, says Timmy Larigi, watch it progress, which is relevant to looking at the interaction between nutrients and the chemical. Timmy Larigi says one of their hypotheses is that the toxic substance is directly affecting the embryo's ability to use food. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Allison Dunn.
Can environmental studies bring long-forgotten plant species back from extinction? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Planetary history can hold keys to preserving species when the climate changes. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jonathan Wilson, assistant professor of biology and environmental studies at Haverford College, examines how plant fossils can help current plants survive for generations.
There's a famous quote often misattributed to Yogi Berra. It is difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. How can we arrive at better estimates of the way climate change will impact ecosystems? There's only one Earth, after all, so a global experiment is impossible and undesirable. The answer is by turning to planetary history. There's a rich archive of environmental conditions preserved in fossils. Plant fossils, in particular, are key sources of environmental information. Aspects of plant anatomy, including leaf size, leaf shape, and wood structure, record and respond to environmental change in a predictable biophysical way. The same aspects of form and function that distinguish an oak forest in Spain from a tropical grove in Brazil can be inverted to derive environmental information from plant leaf and stem fossils. Our research applies fluid dynamics models to fossilized plant cells extracted from geological material to determine extinct plants' water transport and photosynthetic rates. Through this process, we can quantify the performance and limits of extinct plants. We found plants that lived hundreds of millions of years ago that could transport water and photosynthesize at magnitudes comparable to living plants, but using entirely different anatomical structures that left them more vulnerable to environmental change, such as droughts. This vulnerability may have amplified climatic changes during the Carboniferous period. Extinction and replacement of these forests may have transformed the carbon and water cycles of that era. It's a cautionary tale for the impacts of drought stress and deforestation in our own era. One way to make better predictions is to look to the past, and the history of plant life holds important clues about the planet's future.
That was Jonathan Wilson of Haverford College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.